Unibet. Episode 66. Rob Down, Head Coach, Grand Immo VSV.
That's why you coach. You coach to win. You coach to win championship. It's the greatest feeling there is, and the greatest feeling of achievement for a coach and a team is to win a championship.
Und Dylan Stanley, VEU Feldkirch.
Nowhere in any of these meetings is it about trying to steal Austrian players. To go out and take Austrian players from other teams is not affordable. The plan is to develop within.
Die Tribüne erhebt sich. Und der Hexenkessel kocht. Da bleibt kein Moment, um einmal durchzuatmen. Bring it on. Mit dem Torhänder abgefälscht und die Scheibe im Tor. Aus dem Nichts. Wie schön war das gemacht.
Unibet Hockey O'Clock. Ever since the Unibet Hockey O'Clock podcast was brought back, it was a gimme to have him on again. He's one of the dearest friends of the old podcast. He's also a dear friend of the current new old podcast. Doesn't matter how you want to put it. He is the head coach of playoff bound Grand Immo VSV. He's now on Unibet Hockey O'Clock. And as always, happy to be talking to you, Coach Rob Dom. Glad that you're taking the time.
Well, thanks. That was a very generous introduction. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, you do deserve it. After having already taken so many hours talking hockey on this podcast, and I guess we're going to spend another hour or two today talking about the greatest sport in the world. Talking about recent accomplishments, how does it feel to be playoff bound?
Well, it's really exciting, Martin. I mean, it's been a real grind, and one of the things we talked about when we got together in August was to make the playoffs. And it's been an interesting year with all the things that have transpired throughout the course of the regular season. But to claim a playoff spot with a week left in the regular season is a real feather in the cap of our team, and we're really excited about having achieved what we have to date, and we're looking forward to the challenge of seeing how high we can finish in the standings. And then when the time comes, obviously the playoffs.
Obviously a lot of topics that I want to tackle with you over the course of the next hour. Obviously the many ups and downs this season has featured so far. But one of the recent topics, of course, is the COVID-19 outbreak, another one that has hit your team, which made it impossible for Pulse24 to broadcast a game on Sunday because obviously there was no game. How did this COVID wave and when did this COVID wave hit the team? How did everything transpire?
Well, basically, we had one of our players test positive on Thursday. Which then made it important for us to test everybody on Friday. And then we found out we tested Friday morning and we were prepared to go to Bolzano for the game Friday night. But we found that we had almost half the team positive. And because of that, obviously we couldn't make the journey to Bolzano. We were on the bus and you know, preparing to play. But when the committee got news of the number of cases that we had, they told us to turn around and come back, which we did. And obviously COVID takes a little while to run through your team, so we weren't fit to play on Sunday either. Fortunately, we were all tested today and everybody is negative. And so we'll have a lineup for Pustertal. Well, not quite everybody, but we'll have a lineup for Pustertal Tuesday night.
We're recording this conversation on Monday evening. It's going to be out on Wednesday morning. But as you've been hit twice now by the virus, lead me through your thought process after the second time it's hit. Is it just, oh no, not again?
Well, it is. The first one was really tough because it hit us for 3 weeks. We didn't have a full team together for 3 weeks, and that was a long time because we just kept getting additional cases, and it just took forever to get through that. This one, we were surprised by it because the second time you don't expect it, but it hasn't been as severe, and it obviously won't last as long. So we're just thankful that we're going to be able to get on the ice a lot quicker than we did the last time.
Obviously, less than 5 days of quarantining and being at home. But how do you try to keep up the communication with team leaders and the team itself? Is there a WhatsApp group chat? Are there regular Zoom meetings? How does one have to envision that?
Well, there's a group chat that we have, but the big thing is that the players that are, and we have we had constant testing every day. So the positive people would be tested every day. So and then the people that were negative were able to practice. So they continued on with a regular routine, and then obviously the positive players couldn't take part, and you're dealing with half a team. So Marcel Rodman and Patrick Metrick ran the practices, and I stayed at home, and the players that were positive stayed at home, and we just worked through it that way. And we had played a lot of hockey coming into this, so you know, to have a couple of days was a positive, but it would have been much nicer. If it was a situation where it wasn't COVID related, would have been nice if the schedule had been set up to give us a couple of days, but that didn't work out. But so for the first day or two, it was a bit of a relief just because we had played so much hockey heading into it. But then after that, it gets a little bit monotonous for everybody, and it gets a little bit too long. So we're fortunate that it's gone through as quickly and we're able to get back at it.
And the hockey that you've been playing was extremely successful. You, together with Pustertal, are the two hottest teams in the league right now. You were coming off 8 wins in a row until Pustertal took one in Villach. Now it's another showdown with the Wolves again. That question might seem a little stupid on the surface, but Jens Gustafsson, Graz head coach, after having had an 8-game winning streak, said he's glad that his win streak had ended. He said that in January, because now it's time to start a new one. Were you glad that the win streak ended, or would you have loved to keep it going?
Well, and I understand what he's saying when he makes that comment. But we would have liked to have kept it going. I mean, you never want to lose. Sometimes it's good for you, but I didn't think it was a situation. Usually what happens in a winning streak is you win a couple games at the end that you probably don't deserve to win, and your game deteriorates, and you get a little bit lucky in the last few games. And I didn't think that was the case with us. I thought that we had maintained a pretty steady our game was pretty steady throughout the whole streak, and that's really unusual. So I didn't think we had to lose against Pustertal. They just were better than we were on that particular night. And as you mentioned, they were really hot coming into it as well. So I would have liked to have kept it going for a little bit longer. I would have liked to been able to keep playing and have kept it going until the end of the season, to be honest, because it's not that far until that happens. It was not something that I thought had to end, but when it did, you know, like Jens was saying, you just got to get right back on the horse and get at it to start a new one. And it's hard. A winning streak takes a lot out of you, because it's hard to win that many games in a row. No matter in any league at any time, to win that many games in a row, it takes a lot out of you. You have to pay a huge price to win that many games. It never comes easy. So, you know, it took its toll on us. And I'm hoping that, you know, we don't fall into a trap where, you know, you lose 2 or 3 games in a row coming out of it or more. And fortunately, in some ways, the COVID has disrupted the flow of the season. So it's not quite as dramatic in that regard. So I think that might give us the ability to refocus a little bit because of that circumstance.
Now, you mentioned something that you don't hear all too often from head coaches, that there are good losses indeed. And if one looks at the stats also provided by our good friends at Unibet, there are a couple of losses this year that do stand out, because after every loss in a derby, you kind of rebounded. The first loss in a derby, you won two in a row immediately afterwards. Second loss in a derby against Klagenfurt, you won four in a row immediately thereafter. The third loss in a derby this year, you took another one at the hands of Red Bull Salzburg, and then you ripped off that eight-game winning streak. Were those Klagenfurt losses the best of the year?
Oh, you can't lose to Klagenfurt when you're in Villach. You can't do it. So, you know, as well as we rebounded from it, those losses were really humiliating for our team because they were dramatic. Like, we weren't close in any of those games, really. So, and it's multiplied, I don't know how many times. If you lose to somebody else like that, it's forgotten quickly. But for us here in Villach, if you lose to Klagenfurt, it's not forgotten forever, probably. The 9-1 loss will stick in everybody's minds here until they die. So that's not the way we planned it. It's not what we wanted. On the other side of that, I thought we rebounded really well, as you mentioned, from those losses, and we didn't let it carry on for any length of time. We took our lumps, we paid the price, and then we were strong enough to get ready to play the next game after that and play some real good hockey after those losses.
No. Loss against Klagenfurt is ever taken lightly in Villach, and I should have probably phrased my question a little differently. The losses, one might assume from the outside, were good because of the ripple effects of the losses that came after, meaning win streaks. What does it say about the constitution of your team that after each and every derby loss, the team rebounded?
Well, I think it says a lot. I think it says a lot because the stress after those losses is dramatic. So it's as I mentioned earlier, it's multiplied a lot. So there's even a greater challenge to come back from those. And I think it says a lot about the character of our team that we were able to respond in the way that we did.
Now, the last game action took place on February 16th. Hopefully the game tomorrow will be happening. We, of course, will know by Wednesday when this podcast comes out. But your team has been very active, obviously, on another front when it comes to, quote unquote, free agents and bringing in some people. What led to the decision to release Andreas Bernhard and get a change on the goaltender position before the playoffs?
Well, I think it was just a matter that we didn't feel Andreas had played to the level that we needed. We'd given him numerous opportunities to assume the number one role with our team. And unfortunately for us and unfortunately for him, he just didn't play at the level that we needed our number one goalie to play at. We were really happy with the way Ali Schmidt had played, but it's a lot to ask of a 21-year-old young goaltender to carry a team that's bound for the playoffs. And we felt that we needed to shore up our goaltending position if we were to have success in the playoffs. So that's why we made the move that we did. It wasn't, it's not a slight on Ali's ability. We're really comfortable and confident that he's going to be an excellent goalie and is an excellent goalie, but we just didn't feel it was a wise move to put all that pressure on him at this point. He did a real good job last year in the playoffs, but that was a different circumstance. He was thrust into it because of injuries and responded really well. But, to put that on him, I didn't think was fair to him, and I didn't think it was fair to our team. So we tried to upgrade the goaltending position, and I think we've been able to do that with Tommy.
You just mentioned him. You brought in Tommy Kahunen now. If one reads the papers, especially in Carinthia, where there's two or three hockey pages each and every day in the papers, one might have already read that the market's fairly dried up. How quote unquote empty is the market indeed if you're now looking for reinforcements?
Pretty empty. It's been like that all year, to be quite honest. It's been a very strange year for availability of players. There haven't been any available. There's been teams looking for a long time to find people to shore up their teams. Some have been able to get players, But for the most part, it's a very, very thin market, and it's difficult to get players. Not only, I mean, not necessarily. You always want quality players, but it's hard. It's always hard to get quality players. But even this season, it's been even more difficult just to get players. Period. So it's been a very thin market and a very difficult market to wade into if you have to add people to your team.
Then again, you chose to add Tommi Kaunen to your team. He's coming in from Straubing after a fairly up and down season. What narrowed the choice down to him?
Well, there weren't. I think that first of all, there weren't a lot of options, as we just sort of discussed. But we looked at his resume, we looked at his track record, we looked at the successes he's had in some top leagues, and not that long ago. So we just felt that by adding him, we've made our goaltending better, and that was basically what we had set out to do, and we felt that he was able to do that for us. So that's why we made the move. And I think we were a little bit fortunate to get him, because I think other teams were interested in him as well. So, I think that I don't think there's any question that he's going to, he's going to make our team better. And that's what you always try and do when you try and add someone. And, we're confident he'll be able to do that for us. And at the most key position in the game. So,
appreciate your honesty and openness of talking about it. I got two more follow-up questions as regards that signing, because obviously a lot of fans also have questions about it. What makes you confident? What were the criteria where you thought you might be getting the Tommi Kaunen, who at times dominated in Bern, for example, and not the Tommi Kaunen, who had an up-and-down season in Straubing?
Well, we don't know. I mean, we're just gambling gambling to a certain extent that we're going to get the goalie that from a couple years ago, and not necessarily the goalie that played in Straubing. We did a little bit of research and we looked at the situation in Straubing and talked to some people, and I've just felt maybe that a different environment might be more positive for him, and so. Based on what he's accomplished in the past, we feel that he'll be able to get back to that level of play. And if he does that, he's going to be a very good goalie for us.
Now with Pesco Rovani, with Kudleskis, with Sedlacek, with Andreas Bernard, with Tommi Kaunen, the goaltender position has been quite a revolving door the past couple of years in Villach. How desperate are you, or how much do you want to stop this revolving door from revolving?
We'd love to do that, because goaltending is the number one position in hockey. And, if you go back a couple of years ago when Brennan Maxwell was here, I think he was an outstanding goalie. He gave the team outstanding goaltending throughout the course of the year. And it was a team that challenged for the top six that year, and largely because of Maxwell, because he played so well. So we're hoping that this will stabilize that position. And if you stabilize that position, you stabilize your team, because if your goaltender is playing at a high level, and if you just look around the league, teams that have made, there's been a number of teams that have made changes with their goaltending, and teams have been successful when their goaltenders have played well, and teams have been in trouble when their goaltender hasn't. And, we're hoping that he's going to be an upgrade for us, and he's going to give us that stability between the pipes that every team needs. And, especially when you're heading into the playoffs.
We're not even there yet. And of course, the same old phrases keep popping up. Offense, of course, wins games. Defense wins championships. Now, the offensive part of your team really started to click midway through the season. You're leading the league in goals. You're tied in goals with Snoimo at the point of this recording with two fewer games. At what point did you think, wow, this offense is really on a roll?
Well, that's a really good question. One of the things we looked at in the summer is to build three lines that could score. And because of that, we went with three import defensemen rather than four, which I think every other team has, with the exception of maybe Klagenfurt. And but I think the majority of the other teams have three import defensemen. So we forego for an extra defenseman as an import for forwards. And then we've had some players that have probably exceeded expectations. You know, we knew Johnny Hughes was going to provide offense for us. We knew Kosmichuk was going to provide offense for us because of what they've done in the past. Same thing with Chris Collins. Carlson had a good year in Phylak before, but you know, nobody was certain what he was going to produce, and he's done a very good job offensively. And then also Krastenbergs has been a real positive offensive player for us. And we've done this without probably our number one center, Rick Schofield, missing the majority of the season. So that makes it even more impressive that we've been able to score as much as we have. And then also Benjamin Lansinger has stepped up with his offensive production. Marco Richter has produced for us offensively. And we've been able to, when someone has been dry, somebody else has picked up the slack. And there's been some nights where everybody's been scoring. And then we have the ability to score in bunches. And there's been other nights where goals have been hard to come by, but there's always been somebody that's been able to produce for us offensively and give us a chance to win games. And I'm not sure exactly at what point in the season we felt that, I guess maybe when we played Graz and we scored eight goals, and then we had a couple of games where we scored six goals in a row, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're thinking, yeah, we're a pretty good offensive team, and I can't remember exactly when that was, but we've been able to maintain our offense pretty well through the course of the year. At the beginning, we had some struggles. We got lots of chances but didn't finish, but as the season has progressed, we've been a little bit more efficient around the net.
And then again, I vividly remember that you sent in a voice message for the league preview podcast that I recorded in September. And back in the day, or back at that time, a lot of people were wondering if Fila, for some reason, had stumbled into a cash cow because of all the high profile signings that were taken. He said it's quite the contrary, that it's all within a reasonable budget. And then again, you kept adding players throughout the year. There was obviously Alexander Rauchenwald being brought in. Yeah. There was Travis Oleksak being brought in. At what point did you think, wow, this is indeed an embarrassment of riches as regards offensive talent?
Well, when Schofield went down with his injury, we decided to react by bringing in someone who could play center, and that was Travis. So that was out of necessity, because especially with the way the market was, you couldn't, if we would have had another injury at center at some point, we knew Schofield was long-term, it could have been a disaster. So we filled that hole very, very quickly. And then Alex just kind of fell into our laps, and it was a no-brainer to add a quality Austrian player to our lineup. And had that happened before Oleksak was signed, that may have changed our thought process. We may not have signed Travis because Alex was a center and could take that spot, but it didn't happen that way. And then, when Alex, one of our desires has always been to try and improve the Austrian content of our team. And when a good Austrian player like that became available, you know, we jumped at the opportunity to add him to our lineup. It was, like I say, it was a no-brainer for us. We had the opportunity and we took advantage of it, but I'm not going to tell you how much our players are making, obviously.
I don't want to know, in all honesty.
Yeah. But I will reiterate what I said in the summer or in the fall. This is not a high budget team. This is a reasonably budget team. We increased the budget from previous years because, that was the desire of that's the mandate of the organization here, is to put the best possible team on the ice within the framework of our budget. So the budget was increased a little bit, but not a dramatic amount. And we were able to find people that fell into that budget and have produced for us. And some players are making a little bit more than others, which is always the nature of it. But overall, it's well within we haven't extended the budget. Let's put it that way.
And then again, I want to refocus on the embarrassment of riches term that I just used, because it's probably now fitting more than ever with basically everybody being on board with Anton Karlsson's injury obviously not being as bad as once feared, with Renas Krastenberg's coming back from the Olympics. How stacked is the roster right now?
Well, we've got our guys back, and Anton's a little bit of a question mark because we don't know how he's going to respond from his knee injury. I think he's going to be fine, but that remains to be seen. Krastenberg was playing extremely well before he went to the Olympics. And when those guys were out of the lineup, other players stepped up. And that's one of the things that's been really noticeable with our team this year. We have enough depth that when those type of things happen, we haven't missed a step, because other players have assumed maybe more prominent roles and have excelled in them. Marco Richter is one that comes to mind. Maximilian Rebernig is another, who, when these players went down, they were given an opportunity to step in, and they took full advantage of it. And if you can, you just have to look at our record and see that the injuries that might have been terminal in previous years haven't had that impact on our team this year. And it's largely because of the players that we added in the summer that we felt were quality in those positions, and that could move up in our lineup. And as it's turned out, they have. And other players like Benjamin Lansinger has had a real solid year. There's not a lot of players in our league, if you look around, that are, you know, where you've got 20 and 21 year olds that are playing on a regular basis and contributing. And so we've been really happy with the way those players have stepped up when we've needed to with injuries and what have you.
Now, some of the players on Fila's team have been enjoying your teaching for a second year in a row. For a couple of them, it's new to play in your system, to play in your structure. And I've heard it time and time again from players who come into a rub-down-led team, and then first of all their heads start spinning because it's a lot of information to digest. How do you try to integrate new players to your system and make the transition as smoothly as possible?
Well, you're right. There is a lot of information, and what we do at the beginning of the season is we provide a lot of information, basically all the information, all the things we're going to do through the course of the year. And we want to have a team that has the ability to make adjustments. And the only way to make adjustments is if you have the ability to play different ways. And the only way you have the ability to play different ways is if you can do different things. And so we bring those things in at the beginning of the year. And then we spend the rest of the year repeating them, teaching them. And then at some point, the confusion and the overwhelmedness, if that's a word, in the preseason is replaced by confidence and understanding and the knowledge that we're making adjustments, we're not panicking. And so and by that I mean, if you can play the game a number of different ways and then you just decide one night to play it one way and the next night to play it another, that's not a big deal for the players because they're confident in the systems that we've worked on and done in practice for hours on end. But if you just throw something new at them without that ability, then there's a chance that panic. It looks more like a panic move instead of a well-prepared adjustment. And then I think that makes it a little bit more difficult for the players, and they're not as confident because they haven't had the chance to be well versed in how we need to play.
And again, was there ever a point this year where you thought, okay, now everybody's got a full grasp of what I want them to do, or is that still an evolving process?
It's still evolving. I mean, we've gotten a lot better at it. You know, as you can tell, we've had some success, and you don't have success without, being comfortable with how you play. So we're getting better at it, but it's a constant desire for, I mean, you're never going to be perfect, but if you strive for perfection, you're going to be excellent. And that's what we try and do, is we try and be excellent in a striving for to be as good as we can be. And you know, that's, it's never where you say, okay, we've got it now, because the next game, something will happen. You think, oh goodness, we don't have it. So it's just a matter of keeping working at it. But we're much further ahead now than we were at the beginning of the year. And that's obviously what, you know, that should happen. And that's what's been happening for us.
And then again, we all know that playoff hockey is a whole different animal. Now that you are playoff bound, now that you're very likely remaining in the top six and not having to go through the grind that's going to be the pre-playoffs, how much of, let's call it, fine-tuning is there still to be done to get your team playoff ready?
Well, I think you're always trying to do that. You're never comfortable with where you're, as a coach, you're never comfortable with where your team's at. You're always trying to make it better. We'll use the time we have between the 9 or 10 days that you have before the pre-playoffs and our playoff series. We'll use that time to continue to prepare our team. But a playoff series is totally different than the regular season, and you have to be playoff ready, more so mentally than anything. And that's something we have to really focus on, is the mental side of it, and prepare ourselves mentally to accept what playoff hockey is all about. Because what's been successful up until this point, we'll have to be a lot better at it if we want to succeed in the playoffs, because everything is a little bit more difficult, and you have to be better in order to make sure that you can have playoff success.
I know you won't be giving away too much, but when you talk about getting a team mentally ready, is there some kind of magic trick, something that you try to do with your team, or is it as individual as it gets?
I think it's a combination of the two. There's no magic trick, because if I had the magic trick, I'd be coaching at someplace else, because that would be a very, very valuable trick to have. But it's just a matter of you have to work with each individual, because each individual is different. And when you get into playoff hockey, each individual has to raise their game and be prepared to raise their game. And the team has to raise its game collectively. So the collective part of the team is the preparation that you go through with your practices and what have you. But to raise the individual performance of the player is a lot more mental than physical. And it's just a matter of making sure the players understand their role, understand what you need from them to be successful. So communication is a huge part of that. And trying to make it as easy for each individual player to understand what your expectations are for them, for the team to have the greatest success. And players are measured differently. When I talk to Johnny Hughes, his expectations within the team are different than Felix Maxis, for example. But you want every player to be able to give the maximum they can for the role that they have within the team for the ultimate team success. So that's, you know, the communication and the understanding for each individual player, knowing what he needs to do, I think is probably the most important thing, and rewarding them, obviously, when they're able to contribute.
Speaking of rewards and speaking of John Hughes, when he was brought in this offseason, a lot of people, a lot of experts said, well, his best years might be behind him. And now he's already tied his last year's production this year already with, I think, 16 fewer games. And he got a 2-year contract extension. How much or how happy are you for him for this extension? And how many good years do you think he's still got left?
I'm really happy for him. I think he's been, I'm a huge fan. I've always been a huge fan of Johnny Hughes. I've coached against him for every year that I've been in the league. I've coached against him until this year. I've always liked the way he played. His offense speaks for itself, but his competitiveness and his drive to win are things that, you know, I've really been, was new to me a little bit, because you don't see that as much until you work with somebody every day. So I'm really happy with his contract extension. I'm glad he's staying here, and I don't know how many years he has left, but I'm not going to limit Johnny Hughes with the way, because of the way he plays and the hockey instincts that he has. What happens with a lot of players that rely on their skating and their legs, the players can lose that as they grow older. You don't usually lose your hockey instincts and your intelligence. It takes a little bit longer to lose those things. And Johnny has those things in spades. So I'm not going to predict how long he's going to be able to play at a high level, because when you have those instincts, you know, it's hard to say when the game is going to be too much.
Then again, nice proof of his body of work this year, that or a nice reward that he gets a 2-year contract extension. When those decisions are made, and obviously the future shapes up to be fairly bright in Philly, how much of a say do you have at the table when it comes to contract extensions and the duration of new contracts? Do you have a say at all, or do you take a backseat and let others do the decision thing?
I have a say in that. We work together as a group to make those decisions, and I'm part of that. I'm part of that group, and I have a voice, which I'm really grateful for, because it's important for me to be able to have my opinions heard, and they are, and that makes my job a little bit easier to know that I have some input in that area. But it's a group of us that ultimately make those decisions, and we listen to opinions, and then we come up with the solution or the end result, and that was the case with Johnny and the other players that we'll sign. It's everybody talks about it, and you know, my voice is part of that, and I'm very glad for that. I'm very glad for that, because it's you know, I like being involved in the team side of it. So I'm fortunate that I'm able to have some input.
Then again, how much of your head is in the here and now, and how much of your thoughts are already going towards next season, or maybe even the season thereafter with a 2-year contract extension to Johnny Hughes? Is there ever a point where you 100% in the here and now, or is there always something in the back of your head as regards the next seasons?
Both, you know, I'm always 100% in the here and now, but next season is part of the here and now when you're looking to build your team. So when that subject is brought up in the now, then that's the subject that's on the table and the discussion around it. And then when we're to practice, the coaching side of it is there. And then when you're in your game preparation, the coaching side of it is there. But it's not impossible to manage both of those scenarios. And so just whenever the topic is there at the moment, that's where the focus is.
I've also consulted with our good friends at Unibet as regards the season that you guys been having, and they put together a fairly impressive reel of numbers. And I want to talk to you about one of the things that kind of illustrates the journey and the rocky road you might be on until getting hot. You started the season with 1-16 odds to win the championship. That skyrocketed in October to 1-41, and it's now down to 1-11 odds. Kind of showing how bumpy a season might be. But looking back at that journey, is that an accurate description? And just knowing that odds makers are usually fairly early on to developments and things that might be happening. But is that an accurate description of how things have been going in Philly?
I think so. I mean, when you look at the past history of the team here in the last few years, I don't know how many years it's been. The team hasn't finished in the top six for, I don't know how many years, 4 or 5 or 6 or something like that. So the odds makers are going to automatically assume that we're not going to do it, because that's what you would predict based on previous history. So then when you get into the season, we didn't get off to a great start. So then they're thinking that they're licking their chops and saying, yes, we were right where we this team is going to be where it's always been. And then, you know, as the season progresses and you start to play a little bit better, they recognize that and the odds change. So it makes sense based on the way our season has gone that our evolution has been a fairly gradual one. And then over the last little while, as you mentioned, we've been, I think since Christmas, we've been one of the top teams in the league, top three for sure. So once that happens for an extended period of time, then people take notice.
They obviously do. And our good friends at Unibet are still having a nice offer for all the listeners out there. There is an odds boost of 400% for every new customer that registers on Unibet. Just use the code HOCKEY-BONUS and get a 400% boost from 10 euros to 40 euros. All info in the show notes of this podcast. One interesting thing, Coach, that you mentioned is that the team in Villach hasn't been like as far on top as you are right now. And one might be looking, and I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but one might be already looking at Villach being one of the three teams that gets to choose a quarterfinal opponent. If indeed that happens, how would that process look like? Who gets a vote? Is it the coaches? Is it a team? Is it a management? Is it a combination of the three?
I think it's a combination of everything. We haven't discussed or talked about that because it's a little bit further on in the future. But once it gets a little bit closer, or if it appears to be a reality, then that discussion will be made. And I think that you want to take in. I mean, when I've done it in the past in Linz, it's been a collective effort with everybody involved to try and determine what is the best choice to make. And I mean, it's like the league is so close that there's no obvious choice because the teams are so good. It's dangerous to have a pick. It's great in one way because you get to choose your opponent, but it's also detrimental in another way because you get to choose your opponent. Because when you choose your opponent, it's a red flag for them and a real motivator for that team to even though they're motivated to start with, and then the fact that somebody's picked them just multiplies that motivation. So I'm hoping we'll get an opportunity to pick because we've had that would say that we've had a very successful season and we would look forward to being in that position.
And then again, I've always wondered, and of course, a lot of fans out there are wondering as well, and you've already kind of deeped into it a little bit, that motivational aspect. Of course, the other team, the team that gets picked, says they picked us because they think they have a better shot advancing against us than against other teams or another team. How much of your motivational toolbox does it take away when you are the team that picks someone?
I don't think it takes any motivation away. I don't think that changes anything from your side just because you picked the team. I don't think it puts more outside pressure on you because the expectation is because you pick someone, the media, the fans, they say, well, you picked them, then you must think you're going to beat them. But internally, it doesn't have an impact because, your preparation has to be the same. I think the league is so close and so tight that just because you have a pick doesn't mean you're going to pick, you get a chance to pick a poor team. That's not going to happen. And so it doesn't change internally at all. It's just the outside pressures are a little bit greater because of having had to make that pick, and the motivation for the opponent is a little bit greater because you picked them.
And of course, you mentioned in the media people were guilty as charged in that regard, and I'll try to let my team know that we're not drawing too many conclusions as to who picked whom. Just happy that we're hopefully going to have 21 rounds in the upcoming playoffs. And absolutely. How these players are gonna turn out and how they're gonna unfold, we're hopefully gonna see that on Pulse 24 and all the different team streams. I just wanna round out this conversation asking one question, and I think I've already asked you the question when you got to Villach in the first instance, but that hunger for a championship. And lots of other league places have had the honor to enjoy a championship since Villach had its last one in the spring of 2006. How much of that hunger do you feel when you go to the rink, when you are at the games, when you talk to fans, when you talk to players?
Well, there's a huge hunger. This is a very good hockey town. They're very passionate about their team, and because of that, they put emphasis on on being successful. And you can feel when the team is going well, you can feel how encouraged everyone. And obviously, conversely, when things aren't going as well, they're vocal about that as well.
10 years ago, you brought a championship to the great hockey town of Linz, a championship that no one really expected at the start of the year. What would it mean to 10 years later bring a championship to Villach?
Oh, wow. That's why you coach. You coach to win. You coach to win championship. It's the greatest feeling there is, and the greatest feeling of achievement for a coach and a team is to win a championship. You know, there's greater feelings of joy in your life, you know, your kids and your things like that. But as far as sports goes, that's the ultimate. So it would be, that's what you strive for. That's what everybody works towards. So I can't even begin to describe the feeling that a person would have. I've been fortunate to have those feelings in the past, and you always strive to have it again because there's nothing better.
Hopefully, according to a lot of Villa fans, that eventually will happen down the road. But at this point in time, it makes me proud to announce that you're going to be not only on this podcast today, but you're going to be the first guest of many in 4 days' time already, when a new season or series within the podcast comes out. It's called Flying High. We're going to talk extensively about that championship run from 10 years ago. You are going to be the first of many protagonists to look back on the season. That podcast comes out on the 27th of February. I'm very much looking forward to it, as I know you are, because there are so many great memories to be shared of that team. But for the time being, it's just me to say thank you very much for taking such extensive time. Looking forward to seeing you in the playoffs.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's been overdue getting him on the podcast and also talking a little more about Austria's second league, the Alps Hockey League. Also, in a race for the playoffs right now, a lot of things that are going down. He's just recently recorded his 500th point for one of the biggest organizations in the Alps Hockey League. He is, of course, Dylan Stanley of the VfK, and he's now on Unibet Hockey O'Clock. Dylan, so glad that you're taking the time.
Martin, I really appreciate you having me on. This is an exciting time.
It is indeed an exciting time. We're recording this on a Friday, of course, a big tilt coming up against the Steel Wings tomorrow. But yesterday, you just came back after being down 4-1. Are those the days that even you at an advanced stage of your career makes you think, this is why I'm playing hockey?
Yeah, it's exciting. It's so fun when you have those comeback wins, especially at home. And it was just by coincidence that my mom and dad had came from Canada this last week. So that was their first game watching this season live. And the amount of energy you get from those last minute goals and third period wins is huge, no matter your age. And it's obviously exciting seeing the young guys getting so excited after big wins like that. But yeah, it's just the way our team's been rolling lately. We're ready for whatever's thrown at us.
Obviously, a lot of great statisticians over at Unibet, and they, of course, had a look at Fabio Fecchia's season, dissected it a little bit. Is it fair to assess that your season, as of right now, is really the tale of two seasons?
Yeah, and I think that stems from starting the season with a really young team, an inexperienced team. And we asked a lot from some players that have never been asked to play certain situations. And we were patient. You know, we didn't panic as much as people around us may have panicked. We kind of, you know, held to what we thought would work at some point during the season. And I think we're seeing that. We put ourselves behind a little bit, obviously, but we're catching fire at the right time. And let's just hope that the second half of the season continues the way that it has, and we can take that momentum into these pre-playoffs and qualification rounds.
Just to get some people back home, the listeners up to speed, you started the season with a W, then you lost six straight games. Then after going winless for a month, you won another game. And just to prove that the losing streak wasn't a fluke, you lost another eight consecutive games. Was there ever a point where some doubts were creeping into the locker room, or did you see it as your job personally as a captain, as a leader of the team, to avoid letting those doubts creep in?
Yeah, I think the leaders of our team and our management, we really did do a good job just trying to stay patient. We knew that the way that the Alps hockey was going to play this year was, if we got hot at the right time, it would be okay. We knew that a lot of players needed to learn, and we had to be patient with them. So, you know, most players, when they sit in a dressing room that's lost eight games or six games in a row, the video sessions would be painful. There'd be yelling, there'd be screaming. And we really stayed away from that. We really wanted everybody to stay positive. We wanted young players to get confidence. You know, if you weren't seeing it on the stats sheet at the end of the game, maybe we could show you a play in the video that if it went just a little bit better, it would have produced a goal or stopped a goal. And that's harder than just yelling and screaming. But when you have young players and some of this new generation coming up, that doesn't really work so well as it maybe did 15 years ago. And I think players were able to gain confidence even though we were losing games. And it just took us to kind of find a way to create momentum. And fortunately, at the right time, we started playing a couple of those derbies with Bregenzerwald and Lustenau. And the older players on the team and the management knew that was really going to be the turning point. Could we turn this season around with some big local wins and some big derby wins? And if we could, that momentum would really carry us into the second half, which is where the games really matter. And we did. We lucked out. We pulled off four wins against our rivals. And from there, players started realizing, wow, we can do this. We can have a 17-year-old in the second line. We can have young guys killing penalties. We can find a way of doing it. And it took some luck, of course. I'm not going to say that we found a new way to play hockey by any means. But I think the patience we showed early with players and the patience we were given from our fans, they support early with losing streaks was not easy for them as well. And from there, all that support and patience and teaching really helped turn things around. And now you're starting to see the fruit of that labor. And let's just hope that for a couple more games that continues.
How close, after going on that second long losing streak, were you in terms of try an exorcism or some other fancy thing to get the ship on track? Other way to ask, how difficult is it to indeed stick with the process?
It's tough, and you know, obviously being the elder statesman, the older player on the team, along with a couple other guys, you know, you only have so much hockey left in you. And when you're losing and you're not happy losing and you're not used to losing, it's difficult personally. And I think for me, I was able to keep that positive energy around the rink. A lot of that stems from working with the kids and trying to be happy and fun. But coming home at night, I think my wife probably took the brunt of it. You know, is that frustration would stem out when you get home at night and you just kind of want to complain and you know, kind of vent your frustration a little bit. But around the rink, the guys did a really good job kind of realizing we were close. We were never getting blown out. It just needed a little bit more and we didn't need to panic. It's not easy. It isn't. I think every athlete would say that's the hardest time, but I think that's where teams really come together. And I think you see that now is we have a pretty close group, even though there's a 16, 17-year-olds and 38-year-olds in the dressing room. We've really helped each other and we believe in each other. And you know, last night example was perfect. You know, is we had everybody chip in last night. And when that happens and we have good goaltending, we're a difficult team to play against.
Now, I have two follow-up questions, and I'm sure you made a lot of listeners curious. What does it sound like when you're trying to vent, when you're trying to let off some steam? Do you look at certain situations? Oh, if the puck just could have bounced differently? Do you look at bigger picture stuff? What are you trying to focus on?
Yeah, I think on a day-to-day basis, sometimes you just kind of want to vent about the day. You know, maybe practice didn't go well. Maybe some of the older players weren't moving very well. Maybe some of the young guys were kind of sleeping. You know, I think our problem early on is we didn't have a lot of offensive skill up front. We couldn't score goals. That's why we weren't playing, you know, that's why we weren't staying in games, was we just couldn't put the puck in the back of the net. And in practice, when you're just trying to break down the basics and get back to a hard pass tape to tape and a quality shot, and that wasn't working, that's where it got difficult. And that's where you'd come home at night and be like, I take a lot of ownership on trying to help coach and teach. And when you feel like you can't do it some days, or guys just aren't getting it, I think I looked inwards a lot and just kind of said, like, am I doing something wrong? Like, is this, you know, are we not teaching properly? Are we not coaching? Are we not helping enough? I think that's kind of maybe a good thing and a bad thing, is I want to help. And when things aren't going well, you feel like maybe it's my fault and stuff like that. But I think it just took time. I think we really did ask a lot from players early on. We wanted to, and you know, some of these training camps here in Austria, they go quick. You don't have ice early on in the summer, and all of a sudden you're playing games and boom, the season starts. And a lot was asked of young guys. And but yeah, I think the venting either went from I just kind of want to bitch and complain a little bit, to the difficult venting is when you feel like, man, am I screwing up? You know, am I not doing the right things? And I think that's where, you know, having a good family around you keeps things positive, right? You know, I wake up and I have my two little kids that, you know, they might make fun of you from losing, but at the same time, like, they want to just go out on the ice and have fun. And I think that really helps as you get older, having a good support system around you to keep things positive. And I think for me on a personal level, that really made a difference this year when things weren't going so well.
Now, we covered the first follow-up question. The second, obviously, you already touched on a little bit. There is a huge gap in age, and that, no offense towards you or Steve Bernstall as the two elder statesmen on Fairkir, but with hockey being the lowest common denominator that puts this room together, how do you try to bridge these age gaps? And you mentioned the 17-year-olds. There are a lot of 20, 21-year-old millennials on the team. How do you as a leader try to bridge that gap, not only on the ice, but also off the ice?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first thing is you keep control of the stereo. You can't let those young guys have control of the music. That's painful. So that was step one this year, is to keep control of the music, myself or Steve or one of the older guys. But yeah, you're right. The common denominator is hockey. A lot of these guys have more in common with my son, who's 9 years old. And that's no shot to them. It's just, you know, they're into video games and, you know, different kind of things like that. But I think sometimes it keeps myself or it keeps Steve young. Maybe we're a little goofy around the dressing room sometimes, just to kind of feel a little loose. The young guys give shots for being the old guys and stuff like that. But I think there's just a lot of respect. We have some young players that really have a high level of respect for some of the older guys and what they bring to the table. And I think it goes back the other way is, you know, some nights I will play with some really young players and I ask a lot of them, and I respect they're going to make mistakes. And I think when you show that patience to a younger player, that maybe a junior coach didn't, or, you know, another hockey coach in their career maybe didn't, it goes a long way in like creating an equal communication, an equal playing field. You know, it's not like the young players we have are all draft pick prospects and all these kind of things. You know, we have some guys that maybe just didn't get enough time in their younger careers. And now they're starting to see that with a little confidence, they can play at a certain level. But yeah, the odd time in the dressing room, there's some interesting conversations going on. Sometimes I have no idea what these guys are talking about, but I'm sure when Steve and I talk about a movie or a TV show or a song on the stereo, they're probably looking at us like, who are you guys? So it goes back to Super Bowl last week. Steve and I were pumped to see Dr. Dre and Eminem and Snoop Dogg, and these guys are just like, man, that's like on my oldies playlist. So
time flies, indeed.
Time flies. Yeah.
I heard that as well. Yeah. We're officially old, and I'd count myself towards that group as well, obviously, but still, at the very least, some young people are listening to podcasts. So maybe that's our way to reach them and still preach our message with the high index finger, obviously. Okay. Obviously, there's one date we need to talk about. It's January 27th this year. Your game against LMZ, you recording your 500th point for the organization of Feldkirch. What do you make of individual accolades like this?
Yeah, it's kind of a tough thing, you know, growing up in Western Canada and stuff like that. I was never really grown up to care that much about an individual's, you know, success. It was always kind of a team thing and stuff like that. And I don't think I've ever really celebrated an individual success, but I'll be honest, this one actually felt good. I think because when you look at the list of players that have played here in Fau, it's pretty incredible. You see the names on the walls in the rink. You know, you've met a lot of these guys, and like Gerhard Pushnik and Connie Dorn and Rick Nashheim. And there were some amazing players that played here. And I could go on. Some guys that, you know, from Sweden that have came here, the Gustafsons and stuff like that. These guys were amazing players that did really well. And they did really well in some of them in the NHL. And so I think it just kind of hit home that it was like, wow, this is, you know, I don't consider myself, just because I maybe have the points that maybe kind of gets up near some of those names, I don't consider myself to the same level of some of these players. But I think it just shows that a club put a lot of faith in me. I was able to stay healthy. And I think that's something I am most proud of is the work that goes into being consistent as an athlete in your older age. But yeah, it was cool. This Feldkirch has become my home. My kids consider this home. My wife considers this home now. And it was really cool to do that. It was cool to see the little under seven players the next day, like, say, congratulations. It was a neat experience. It was. And for an individual accolade, it was kind of the first to celebrate. And I think at this old age, I think that's okay. But it was neat to do it for a club. And I think to do something special in your time with one club that has a rich history and amazing fans and amazing management. I think that really made it hit home. And it was a unique night. It was cool. And it was nice to do.
That's not only the 500th point that will tie you to the organization forever. If one looks at the makeup of the club, you're not only a player, you're labeled as the conditioning coach, you're labeled as the director of player development, you're labeled as a skills coach. When is it enough? I mean, those are four different jobs that you're currently filling up. Is there any time besides hockey or any free time in your life?
No, not really. And that's why I said I have a supportive family. Fortunately, my two kids are at the rink almost as much as me, so that helps my wife. I love to work and I love to teach. And to be honest, I feel like the reason that I've had a successful career at my level is I think the game very well. And so I've always wanted to give back the way that I see the game to other players. And I think going to the rink and working with kids that are 5 years old, 6 years old, and all the way up to the pro team is fun. I love it. I love giving back. I love to teach. I love to coach. And I'm very fortunate that the management team here in Feldkirch has allowed me to have a vision and some goals. They've had the financial support to maybe help with some of these things, whether it was the performance center we built last summer that was the first of its kind in Vorarlberg, whether it was the ability to maybe not be at 100% every practice night for the pro team because I'm on the ice for 3-4 hours before and they'd be okay with that because I also want to help the Knockwooks program. I think it's unique. I think it's unique what our club is trying to do. And like I said, I have a vision. I have a goal to help these young players, and it stems all the way up to the pro players. As you see some of these younger players from the club kind of creating bigger roles, like a Timo Štika. It's been awesome. And it's now starting to stem out into, you know, other kids in Vorarlberg. You know, this coming up next month, we're doing some pretty cool stuff here with creating small star teams in Vorarlberg that hasn't really been done before. And we're going to take some under 8 teams, some under 9 teams, some under 10 teams to places like France and Belgium and the Czech Republic. And it's just a vision I have. And there's a lot of supportive people in some of the other clubs now that are sharing that vision, whether it's Lustenau or Honems or Dornbirn or Montafone. It's pretty cool. And I'm very thankful to, like I said, the group here in Falkirk that's allowed me to have a vision and give me all the support I could possibly have. And now we just need to see where we can take it.
Now, every one of your answers basically leads me to 3, 4, 5 different questions that I immediately attach. We'll try to keep this within the podcast constraints of Unibet Hockey O'Clock. There's so many different things to talk to you about, and obviously we might have to think to bring you back on a repeat appearance here on Unibet Hockey O'Clock. But one of the more interesting topics and one that a lot of fans are not constantly but thinking about a lot is Falkirk trying to get back into Austria's first league, now the Ice Hockey League, a multinational league. You were, depending on whom you're talking to, close last year, didn't get in. You've been working with management, with some of the officials on Falkirk, on making that dream for an entire region possible to get back into the Ice Hockey League. What have you done since being refused or haven't been refused entry last year to this year to make sure that maybe this is the year, or maybe the next couple of years are the ones where you do get over the hump?
Yeah. Like you said, there was disappointment about a year from now or 12 months prior when we didn't, you know, the vote didn't go our way. And that was disappointing. But instead of taking that disappointment and kind of, you know, blaming other people and not doing anything about it, the club has done an amazing job this year. Mickey Lampert and Christian Gross and our president, Pitt Glem, have done an awesome job with the infrastructure around the club. Just the most simple things to how efficient our ticketing system is with, you know, the use of phones and QR codes and online shops and all these kind of things is, it might seem simple to some people, but we all know in Austria, it's not like every rink you walk into has some of these accessibilities. The amount of VIP rooms around our rink for different levels of people and cafes and restaurants has increased. The visibility of our team through sponsorships has gone up tremendously. And I think that goes to the support of some of our big sponsors. Like I mentioned, Pitt, Glem and Volkswagen and Frasthanser and some of these companies have done an amazing job at really, you know, trying to help push forward. And I understand the hesitation to put money in when we're still in the Alps League. I don't think more money in the Alps League necessarily makes anything better. I think the developing younger players at this league is better than just paying for older players that are here for 1 year. And I think we're getting close. We're constantly doing work around the rink. The rink management and the city of Falkirk has been incredible. The support they gave us last summer for some of the new ventures we were doing to develop the players was huge. This summer, I know they're planning on some new things around the rink as well. And this is all that, whether we get in or we don't, they want to make these improvements. Obviously, the goal is to get in, but to have that support from the city and the province and some of your major sponsors, that's incredible. I really hope that we get the opportunity to go in. The financial support that, you know, the junior club would receive, the coaching staffs would receive, the city would be able to do with a bigger club and TV games and all these kind of things. It would be incredible to have the historical club like Falkirk back there. And we're ready for the opportunity. We were ready last year. We're even more ready now. And now, you know, only so much is in our control. And let's hope we put, you know, a, a better proposal together this year again. And if the opportunity is there and it presents itself, we're ready.
Now, I did a fair share of reading, and obviously it's hard to avoid Fairkirk when reading in Faaborgian newspapers. It's basically everywhere. Everybody knows that Fairkirk wants to get into the league. I myself been witness to all the things that have been going on at the rink. I was lucky enough to attend a game in October, and I'm like, okay, this used to be the Stark Old Arena. Now the shiny new rink with new boards and everything that goes into it, or tiny little parts that make up the whole package for Fairkirk to be deemed league worthy, quote unquote. But the one thing you always stumble upon, especially when you're reading papers and hearing opinions outside of Faaborg, that a lot of league people are afraid that there's another fishing rod in a pond with not enough fish. What would you answer those people who look at a shallow market of Austrian players when another Austrian club enters the league?
Yeah, and that is a very hot topic when it comes to, you know, Falkirk trying to move up and maybe adding another Austrian team to the Ice League. And I think the question you got to ask yourself is why is there a shallow pool of hockey players in Austria, and why is it that the national program isn't maybe taking the steps that it should be? Can you say that the Alps League is necessarily developing the players that it needs to also? You know, there's different clubs in the way they're managed in our league as there is the Ice League. There's a lot of different visions. And I think as a country itself, the only way that we're going to develop players properly is financial resources. And so when you have another club with financial resources to help develop players, but you're not willing to maybe let them in because you're worried about players being taken from other clubs or other junior programs, you're kind of burning the candle at both ends. You know, you're not allowing a club to come in and develop players, which is going to add more players for the under 20 national program, which is going to develop more players for the men's national program, which is going to develop more girl players for the women's national program that is very close to the Olympics. Nobody really talks about how we're going to develop more players. They always just keep talking about, well, there's not enough right now. Well, no, there isn't right now, but how are you going to get there? Are we only going to allow the Klagenfurts and the Salzburgs and the Viennas to develop players, which they do a great job and they do develop players? Or are we going to allow more clubs to come in and develop a junior system that develops players? Nowhere in any of these meetings is it about trying to steal Austrian players. To go out and take Austrian players from other teams is not affordable. The plan is to develop within, and maybe that takes time, but if we can develop within, then what, in 3 years, we've added maybe 15 new Austrian professionals to the pro ranks. We've maybe added 20 new Austrians to the Alps League that they can go to other teams. And we've maybe developed a couple female players now that can play up until the age of U16 and maybe add to the women's program. All we would be doing is adding to this pool. Yes, it doesn't look great when you just sit there and look at the paper. Well, where do you get these players? Well, that's our choice where we get these players from. And that's our choice of how we want to develop them. Maybe we want to spend our money on coaching and develop the players that we can. For me, it's really frustrating when I see a lot of our young players leave to Swiss clubs because they get a chance to go to a club that has, you know, 8 to 10 coaches that can help develop them. I think for the player, it's the right thing to do. And I think all the Vorarlberg clubs have the same frustration. But when the Austrian, you know, Ice Hockey Federation or the Ice League and the Austrian Federation, which I know it's not their decision, when we're maybe losing another club that can help develop these players at home instead of them leaving, you're only going to add to the talent pool. And I think it's short-sighted of people to always instantly think, well, what are you going to do by August of 2022 for players? Why does it matter what we do by August? It should matter what we can do by August of 2024. And if we would have got in last year, that'd have been one more year we can develop players with more pro coaches and more money. It would have been another year that our under 16 players, our under 14 players would have got more ice time and more coaching. That would have been one more year of better development. This year, we didn't get up. We didn't have the financial resources to go and hire six professional coaches. So now you have three or four coaches that are doing everything they possibly can and are on the ice for 6 hours to try to help multiple age groups get better. So I wish people would sit back and say, why, what do we need to do to develop more and not rely on just the couple big clubs in Austria? Let's rely on more clubs. Let's have 10 clubs that are developing, you know, quality junior players that can maybe have a chance to go to North America or college. Let's develop more young professionals so that Ice Leagues teams, Alps Leagues teams, they're not all looking for one player. They're all, you know, willing to find multiple players. I think there's just so much more. It's a huge topic, Martin. As you can see, I get a little intense about this one. I feel passionate about development and I just want to see more of it in Austria and we have a chance to do it, but we're kind of being hindered at the moment.
And in all fairness, this is a topic where we could spend afternoons and entire evenings talking about it, not on a condensed podcast conversation, because there are so many different topics that I at the very least want to try to tackle. And one of them is the clubs that did get in. Now I got no real horse in this race, as long as the league keeps growing, as long as all the teams are doing great. I guess that's what we, even as broadcasters, are looking for. And obviously with Pusatal and Ljubljana, two teams got in that you played against last year without a note of enviness or whatever. But are there certain areas where you try to look at what they're doing in the first league where you think, okay, we might be able to do that as well, or that is a good lesson, or that is something that we have to take into account once we do get up or do get back into the league?
Yeah, I think, two quality clubs, both were picked last year. I'm not a person that's bitter because they got to go up. I think you had two clubs that had a good plan. I think if Ljubljana can be consistent with their development, they're doing a great thing for Slovenian hockey. There's some really good hockey players in that country. And you can see that they have the ability to change in and change out some players because there's quite a bit of quality. You can see that Jasenica still with having Ljubljana in the first league, Jasenica was able to put together a team that was in first place in our league. I think if they can continue consistency with that club, they'll do a good job for Slovenian ice hockey. I think Pusatal is one of those historic clubs that has always really had a good junior program. I've always known some good players to come out of that area and some good coaches. And I think this year was probably more of like, for them, how can we sign a good team and whatnot. You can see they've had to make some roster changes this year and stuff like that. But I think the long-term success that Pusatal will come from the development within. I think you'll start seeing some really good young players of the age of 16 to 20 in the next couple of years coming out of that program. I would assume they've got some good long-term development plans with some of the people around there. Diego Scandella does a great job. So I could see them having like a really detailed approach to the way they're going to develop players. And like we just talked about with finding Austrian players, this year was more about how do we build a team that's going to be successful? How do we, have some moving parts and a couple more imports and maybe a couple older Italians that still have some quality in them. I could see that team over the next couple of years, building their roster a little bit different just because they're going to have a little bit more money to develop within. And I think they'll do a great job. So yeah, I think you've got kind of two different situations. Ljubljana has a lot of players at their disposal and a good quality country for hockey. And I think Pusatal, there's definitely some great quality hockey players in Northern Italy, but I think at the same time, I think they probably have a plan that we're going to really build up our junior program and provide for our pro team and maybe get these guys even to the next level.
Now that we talked a little bit about the Fabio's plan and hopefully for a lot of fans' roadmap towards the Ice Hockey League. I wanna go back a little and talk about you personally. An interesting career. Already mentioned the Unibet stats that I'm always provided with, and one of the more interesting stat lines is your very first year in Europe, and it kind of has to do with the question that a lot of fans have been asking, and that I myself heard uttered a couple of times when at Falke games. Back in your first year in Europe, in Rosenheim, you scored 118 points in 61 regular season games. So almost at a pace of 2 points per game. And obviously scoring has come, and I know it always seems as if it's coming easily, but you've had a scoring touch in the Alps Hockey League. Has there ever been a moment where you thought, scoring is a little too easy for me, I should be moving up a notch towards a quote-unquote better league? Or have you always kind of refrained from this step because everything has felt perfect in a moment?
Yeah, it's a
loaded question.
For me, it's a loaded question. It's for me, that's like a two-headed monster. I'm 38 years old and still having success and healthy and playing for a great club with great teammates. So obviously something went well. So I don't like to look it back too often and think, well, what if I did this or what if I did that? Because maybe if I did something else, it wouldn't have worked out. But at the same time, I don't know. I've kind of always had a stigma around me that, like, you know, he's not good enough for certain leagues. And I think it goes back to junior. If you know, when I played in the Western Hockey League and when I had a chance to play for Team Canada at the under 18 tournaments and things like that, I think I was the only player that never got to go to an NHL camp. And I don't have an answer of why. I wish I did, but at the same time, I don't really care to, you know, think too hard on it. Because for me, I'm very grateful for where I am now. And I think I've learned a lot along that way. And I think that's why I love to teach, because I made a lot of mistakes and I maybe listened to the wrong person at the wrong time and things like that. You know, when I first came to Europe, there was better contract opportunities and better leagues. But for me, it was more about the money and I didn't have really an agent or management team around me at the time. And so I maybe didn't make the best decisions at the time. And maybe, you know, in Europe, unfortunately, sometimes you can kind of pigeonhole yourselves in certain leagues and whatnot. But yeah, you know what? I found success at the levels I went to. Do I think I could have had success at higher leagues? Yeah, I do. I have confidence in myself. But at the same time, you know what? I put myself in those situations, obviously. And I didn't do things the right way always. But I'm so fortunate and so grateful to be where I am today and with the family I have and the people around me. So when I look back on it, I just look back on it and think, wow, it was a really good run everywhere I was. And I'm like I said, I'm grateful for the opportunities of all the clubs I've had and it's been a good career. It's been fun.
And I wanted to circumvent the word regret, but obviously there aren't a whole lot of regrets, and that's a good thing. And I want to revert back to something that you mentioned a little earlier, that one of the qualities to your game is that you're thinking the game well. To what regard or to what extent can thinking the game well be learned?
Yeah, you know what, it's... You know, I think in the hockey community, you always hear people talk about hockey IQ. And then you have some people say you can't teach that. And you have some people that, you know, argue it in different ways. And I'm a big believer in development that hockey IQ is for some people is natural, but it can be taught. And I think right now when you watch the game of hockey, you're watching NHL games constantly as you see speed now and you see everything done at an amazing high level. And unfortunately, a lot of our development now is everybody wants to like put a bunch of things on the ice and have our players jump around and do everything really, really fast without thinking. But none of those obstacles on the ice move. None of them make you rethink what you're doing. And so for me, I'm not the fastest player. I'm not the biggest player. I'm not the strongest player. But in general, I believe I can read a play or see where a puck's going to go or see where a defenseman's going to go or be able to manipulate the game the way I want it to happen. And I think sometimes when people watch me, they think I'm slowing down or maybe doing things at a speed that like, well, why doesn't he shoot or why doesn't he do this? And a lot of times it's because I'm waiting for somebody to move so that I can take advantage of a situation. Right. And I think the greatest compliment I've ever had from somebody is that I can find a way to help my line mates score no matter who they are. And I don't want that to sound arrogant because I've been lucky to play with some really good hockey players, but having a brain that works quicker than the opponent on the ice is ultimately what's going to find you success. And I think for me, I've been really fortunate in that area. And I think that's why coaching and development has come so natural, is to be able to teach the young players, you know, if you can think the game and do things at 80%, it sometimes is better than not thinking and trying to go 100% every shift.
You were talking about those great players, and I want to talk about with whom you played, and I want to talk about them in a little bit, but obviously because of the fact that you were talking about doing developmental stuff and everything that goes into it, obviously you can be hit up on social media for your camps that you're regularly conducting. But when looking at your career and looking at some of the teammates that you had, you shared the distinct honor to play with a certain Carey Price back in the Western Hockey League. Then you moved to the Canadian university system with the University of Alberta, where you played with Derek Ryan, a name that sure rings a lot of bells, obviously still in Villach, Fihava this league. Now with the Edmonton Oilers, your hometown club, so to speak. And you've been working a whole lot with Marco Rossi these past couple of years. Hopefully the next big Austrian thing in the National Hockey League. Three very different personalities and players. But if you had the time together, what is the lowest common denominator to two great careers and one hopefully great career?
Good people.
As cliche as it sounds,
good people. You know, when you go back to Carey Price, you could see right away at the age of 15 that this was a talent, and he was going to go somewhere. But what a passionate, good person. I've never seen a young goalie work harder and compete harder than that young man when he was a junior player. Funny story I always tell guys is in juniors, it was during the NHL lockout and the old German goaltender, Olaf Kolzik, he was the owner of my junior team. And during the lockout, he came to our junior team and practiced with us for a couple months. And it was Olaf Kolzik in one net and Carey Price in the other. And the competition that maybe I'm going to say Ole would have been 35, 36 at the time versus a 16-year-old at the other end. It was incredible to be on the ice and witness. They were smashed on crossbars when they got scored on. It was heated. And I'm telling you, it was like, this kid's going to be a superstar. And that was just one thing that, you know, sticks out with Carey. Derek Ryan, what a kind-hearted person. Derek's still somebody I talk to today. And our time at the university was great. We actually got to play on a line together. And when he was living in Villach, myself and his family, and we got together often, whether it was at the Fokker C or we met up in Venice and things like that. We had some good times together. And he actually tried really hard for me to come to Villach. And, you know, even Derek Ryan pumping your tires wasn't enough at the time. But Derek was one of those guys that he saw the game incredible. And, the way that he could play the game so smooth, so fluid, you knew he was going to go somewhere if he was given the right opportunity. And he did. And when he was given the opportunity, he really took it. The years that he had in the Austrian leagues was incredible. And I think the big shining moment was for him is when he went up to the Swedish Hockey League and did what he did. That is not easy to do. And from there, once he got the NHL opportunity, it was, you knew Derek was going to do something with it. And I'm so proud of that guy. That is incredible. That's a great story for a good person, good family. Yeah, Derek did it the right way. And And Marco, yeah, it's been, I'm going to say off the top of my head, probably 3 to 4 years of working with Marco, whether it's during the winter when he's back here in Falkirk, you know, there's been times where seasons have been stopped and all these different things. And so I've been able to work with Marco quite a bit during the winter when he's around. When he was in Ottawa, he came back and forth a couple of times and we had some times to get on the ice. This last year, we got on the ice a lot. This last summer, we were on the ice for about 5 weeks consistently. Marco is a different beast. His work rate is substantially higher than most guys. He can go at a level that other players just can't get to. He wants to work. The second he steps on the ice, it is go time. He challenges you as a coach, which I love. He wants the best out of his session that day. He is constantly asking questions. Why should I do this? Why should I do that? Which I think is great. He should always be asking. I think if a player doesn't understand why, then he's just a robot. Marco is going to do well. Marco is having an awesome year of development. I really like what Minnesota is doing with him. I think him spending the year in a very, very tough league in the American Hockey League is awesome for him, especially the way last season went, just not being healthy the whole year. And you hear from a lot of guys, it's harder to put up points in the American Hockey League than it is the NHL. And you can see Marco's having a lot of success this year. And I think Minnesota has a real diamond in the rough just waiting for them when they need him, which I'm sure will be, you know, next season right out of training camp if Marco's ready. He's an individual I love to work with. I love that relationship we have. It's very businesslike. And I respect that a lot out of Marco and working with him and challenging him and him challenging me is incredible. It helps me. It helps him. And I look forward to many more years of, you know, just being a small part of where Marco gets.
Before rounding out this conversation, hopefully a lot of the younger players who might just practice their English skills a little bit listening to you are still listening, because Derek Ryan, if they don't know him or his story, that has to be one of the more inspirational tales of a player making it to the National Hockey League, quote unquote, undersized, bounced around, caught fire, and ended up in the National Hockey League. Incredible career and still going strong. That is Derek Ryan, but you as a skills coach, someone who's done a lot of work with Marco Rossi, Diamond in the Rough, as you said, with Falkirk players, young and old. And I know this is something that we could be talking about for hours and hours and hours, but is there some kind of favorite drill that you kind of do or drill? And I want to educate the audience a little bit, a drill that doesn't seem all too exciting, but where people and players and aspiring players will take away the most from.
Yeah. Like you said, that's a open-ended question. I think the easiest way to break that down is when you talk about youth players, you know, the younger players here in Falkirk you're working with, my biggest challenge for them is to be thinking all the time on the ice. I bet you sometimes if you were to ask the parents watching the practice, they'd be like, what is going on out there? But I try to engage them, their hockey IQ as much as I can in most practices. And I think the more that I can have them thinking, they might not end up being the fastest player in under nines this year, but when you can think the game at that little young player age, it's incredible what you see. And I think we've built up a really cool group of players that are at that 7, 8, 9, and 10 year old age group here that have been able to kind of take part in that kind of training. So I think at that young age, if I'm listening to this, or I'm a parent that has a young player, is to always challenge decision-making. I think hockey is such a fast sport, and the faster you can make decisions, the better of a hockey player you're going to be. And then once we get up to those players that are, you know, that junior age and that trying to get to the next level, I think a player that I've probably spent 5 or 6 years with is Vinzi Roher, who is doing amazing things this year and will all and likely be the youngest player to get drafted in the NHL draft this year, which is an incredible feat. When I work with a player like that, it's how can I add to his game? And when we talk about Vinzy, it's he does everything very, very fast. So how can I slow him down and find ways that he can open up options? So when we do drills with Vinzy, it's more about adding to his talent with giving him three possible options when he has the puck instead of one. I know that might sound complicated, but when a player skates down the ice across the blue line with the puck, some players have one play in mind they like. With Vinzy, I'm trying to create a way that he can have three options and do what's best based on the defenders, the help that he has, and the situation in the game. So with Vinzy, it's more about adding more tools to his toolbox, we like to say in English. And then when you talk about more finished players, two guys I work with a lot during the offseason is Marco and Timo Meyer from Switzerland. Two completely different players. But at the same time, with those players that are more finished, as much as we want to add to their game, we want to make what they do better. So when Timo does things, Timo's a horse on ice and having an incredible season. When we have Timo on the ice in the summer, we want him doing things as hard as he can, because he's hard to stop when he's going fast. And so with Timo, it's like, how can I add decision-making and making things uncomfortable for the other team at his speed with his size? With Marco, not as big of a frame as Timo, has a little bit more tools in terms of puck handling and whatnot. With Marco, it's more about how can he always be aware of what's around him? Because Marco sees the ice really well. Marco makes plays that most people don't see. So how can Marco and I create drills together that give him an extra second with his head up? Because if Marco has half a second or 1 second with his head up, he's going to find the right player. He's going to make the right play. So with Marco, we don't need to fix how he turns. We need to fix how he turns and gets his head up over his shoulder and has the puck on the right spot on his stick. So it's all just little details, Martin. With the littlest kids, it's challenging their brains. With the medium age kids, it's giving them more tools. And with those older players that are very refined and making their money already, how can we make the best they're at better? And that's the challenge. That's the fun part about being a coach. And that's why I do it.
Sounds great. And I'd love to go on, but I've already mentioned you've got four different jobs just with Ferkir, a whole lot of other things to do. I'm so appreciative of your time. Your career is still going strong. Looking forward to a great campaign with Ferkir and looking forward to having you return talking a lot more skills coaching here on Unibet Hockey Clock. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you very much, Martin.
Exzellente Unterhaltung mit dem schönsten Sport der Welt.
Unibet Hockey Clock.